This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, December 11th, 2008. From Washington, D.C., I'm Leanne Caldwell, sitting in for Otto Bogato. In today's newscast, President-elect Barack Obama makes new announcements about his cabinet concerning health care. We'll hear from single-payer health care advocates about it. Employers settle with Chicago workers occupying their factory for due compensation. And Mothers of Resistance march for human rights in Argentina. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Congress has passed legislation that would halt military aid to countries that use child soldiers. Countries like Afghanistan, Sudan, Congo, and Sri Lanka could be affected. The rules cover countries that directly recruit child soldiers into their armed forces and those who utilize paramilitary groups that sanction the practice. Countries actively working to halt the practice could still be eligible for limited aid from the U.S. The violent political and social crisis continues today in Greece. Several thousand workers and students marched through Greek cities to protest the killing of a teenage boy and the government's economic policies. Addis Okonomou reports.
The government has tried to discourage further violence by saying the demonstrators are minorities of looters and anarchists. But the massive participation in the protest contradicts these statements. According to trade unions and left-wing parties who continue demonstrations today, the government is trying to avoid discussing the root causes of the unrest. Topping their list of complaints are the economic crisis, corruption and state repression, the constant attacks on workers' incomes and rights, and the continuous waves of reforms cutting education and other public services. Yesterday, a Greek court charged one of the police officers involved in the shooting with murder. Another was charged as an accomplice. Both officers are being held in jail pending trial. Solidarity protests have happened this week at Greek embassies and consulates in Italy, Spain, London and Germany. For FSRN, this is Aris Economou.
In northern Iraq today, a suicide bomber killed nearly 50 people in a restaurant near Kirkuk. The apparent target was a meeting of local officials discussing ways to bring peace to the violent city. The restaurant was full of a lunchtime crowd celebrating the end of a Muslim holiday. Photos show the restaurant ripped completely open, debris and rubble everywhere. Despite reports that show Zimbabwe's cholera epidemic is spiraling out of control, the country's embattled president, Robert Mugabe, said today the government has the outbreak under control. He said point blank, there is no cholera, and apparent hopes to dissuade international military forces from coming in to deal with the problem. Officials in Ghana announced today last weekend's presidential election has resulted in a runoff. Neither of the two leading candidates, Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party and John Adda Mills of the National Democratic Congress, was able to garner 50% of the vote. The runoff will be held on December 28th. Underreporting and neglect of HIV/AIDS cases in Chile have led to the deaths of at least three people, and now authorities are holding healthcare officials involved in the scandal accountable. FSRN's Jorge Garatón has more.
The HIV/AIDS crisis emerged in the northern city of Iquique 2 months ago. A Ministry of Health investigation revealed healthcare officials did not notify residents who tested positive for the virus. The investigation turned up 550 unreported cases in all. Now Iquique prosecutors have charged 20 healthcare officials for failure to enforce national disease control provisions. Among those charged are the Regional Health Ministry Secretary, the National AIDS Commission Director, Blood Bank, and public health officials. These are the first charges filed relating to the investigation and more expected, particularly in a couple of Santiago regional health centers. To date, at least three people have died, including a husband and wife who were never informed they had the disease. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garrotón in Santiago.
The Environmental Protection Agency is issuing a new kind of most wanted list this week in an effort to apprehend environmental fugitives. The 23 people on the list are wanted for a variety of crimes, including smuggling chemicals and illegal dumping of hazardous waste. Ironically, the new most wanted list comes as EPA enforcement has been drastically reduced. The number of overall cases brought by the agency's enforcement division is down 25% from 2004. With hurricane season officially over, Texas residents continue to pick up the pieces. Among them are 13 families in the state's Rio Grande Valley, now suing the Federal Emergency Management Association. They charge FEMA has failed to offer adequate assistance. Rachel Clark has more on this story from Houston.
In Austin yesterday, the Texas Supreme Court heard testimony regarding the Texas Access to Justice Commission's work with low-income Texans. Among those speaking before the justices were residents of the Rio Grande Valley. 13 families are suing FEMA in the wake of its response to Hurricane Dolly, which hit the southern part of the state last July. Attorneys charge the government agency is denying claims precisely because of the low-income status of some of those seeking assistance. FEMA has rejected many claims alleging damage to the homes were pre-existing and not related to the tropical storm. But residents like Jose Gonzalez vow to keep fighting.
And if it takes for me to go to court like they ask, we'll go to court.
Reporting from Houston, Texas, I'm Rachel Clark, Free Speech Radio News.
And the number of government executions in the United States dropped to a 14-year low in 2008. 37 inmates on death row were executed, 26 of them in Texas alone. One possible reason for the drop was a Supreme Court moratorium on executions that was in place through April. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
The Senate has received the $14 billion auto industry bailout from the House of Representatives, which passed the measure last night by a vote of 237 to 170. But the Senate has been unable to move forward. Despite its decreased amount and provisions inserted to please the White House, enough senators still have concerns to keep the measure from moving forward. A number of Republicans believe that government assistance will not keep the automakers afloat. Healthcare was the purpose of President-elect Barack Obama's news conference today. Obama attempted to signal its importance. He created a new position for his White House, an Office of Health Reform. To lead that team is Jean Lambrew. Lambrew is currently a fellow at the liberal-leaning think tank Center for American Progress and professor at the University of Texas. Obama also nominated former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. Joining us to talk about Obama's choice is Michael Leidy, Director of Public Policy for the California Nurses Association. Michael, you've been working for universal health coverage for about 18 years, you say. Can we agree that with the appointment of Senator Daschle as head of Department of Health and Human Services and with Senator Obama in office that there's pretty much no chance for a single-payer healthcare system?
I wouldn't agree with that. I think that what determines what kind of healthcare reform we have is how strong of a social movement we build for healthcare justice and specifically for single payer, and also how severe the crisis is, because quite frankly, only a single payer approach is actually going to solve the crisis.
So single payer, though, is different than, or it can be different than universal health coverage. Do you see, with the appointment of Senator Daschle, where do you see reform going? If maybe there is or isn't single payer, what else, what other options are out there?
Well, I think Senator Daschle is someone who gets it. He gets the big picture that this is not just a question of how we pay for health care, but it's also a question of can we replace the healthcare industry that's incoherent but very profitable for some major corporations with a system that actually meets people's needs. And that means changing how we deliver healthcare and how we, as well as how we finance it. So what is likely to happen if you just, you know, follow the Senator Daschle's history is some kind of private-public insurance mix that has a federal board that oversees medical care and it does new emphasis on primary care prevention, obviously with a dose of healthcare information technology. So it's not And we just don't think that will solve the problem.
You all are advocates of U.S. Representative John Conyers' health care plan for universal single-payer system. Can you discuss the most important aspects in that bill? And is there any discussion on that bill possibly being pushed forward in Congress this year?
It essentially sets up a publicly financed, primarily privately delivered health care system based upon progressive financing. So you get rid of the private insurance and companies, you get rid of premiums, co-pays, all the kind of cost shiftings that employers are doing to employees, and you substitute that dysfunctional system, or industry really, with a system that is based upon one plan for one nation. And it would do so by saving employers literally billions of dollars.
Well, what about the other side of the argument about the economy, that getting rid of the private insurance system, especially in these economic times, will be disastrous because the healthcare industry is so major and such a major part of the U.S. economy? How do you respond to those concerns?
Well, we actually are very sensitive to those concerns because the workers who work for these insurance companies, obviously those are key jobs. And quite frankly, a job as a clerk doesn't pay as well and is not as socially beneficial as a job providing direct health care. And so to the extent that we can move those folks into direct care provider positions, that's going to be good for everybody.
Michael Leidy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Leanne. It's a pleasure.
That was Michael Leidy, Director of Public Policy for the California Nurses Association. The Environmental Protection Agency announced that it is dropping two last-minute Bush administration efforts to weaken regulatory controls of power plant emissions and deregulate air pollution in national parks and wilderness areas. Critics charge the EPA's about-face is not coming from a Bush administration environmental change of heart, but from the spotlight the administration has been receiving on such last-minute rule changes that many say will seriously impact the environment. While the administration has agreed to drop some proposals, other efforts to move forward on easing air and water quality standards and loosening the Endangered Species Act remain. As FSRN's Karen Miller reports, a House committee shined some more light on those remaining last-minute alterations.
With President-elect Obama coming into office, Chairman of the House Energy Independence and Global Warming Committee, Edward Markey, says the Bush administration is on the fast track.
Indeed, the Bush administration is on pace to do almost as much damage to our environment in its last 8 weeks in office as it did over the last 8 years.
The administration has targeted several critical environmental areas. The first is to weaken the endangered species list by rewriting requirements for interagency consultations to make sure any action does not jeopardize species. Jamie Rappaport-Clark is the Executive Vice President of Defenders of Wildlife. She testified at the hearing.
The consultation regulations are the absolute heart of the Endangered Species Act. But the administration is on the verge of allowing any federal agency to avoid consultation if the agency unilaterally decides that an action it sponsors is not anticipated to result in take of a listed species, and its other effects are insignificant or unlikely.
Clark says the effects on species are not always readily apparent, and specialists need to be brought in to closely examine all the issues. Bush's plan, however, would change all that.
Under this administration's proposal, however, independent species experts no longer are in the review loop. They no longer review federal agency judgments about the effects of actions that it sponsors, clearly allowing the fox to guard the chicken coop.
Another area the administration is targeting in its final days deals with the Clean Water Act. Currently, the Bush administration is issuing rules that remove protections against mountaintop mining removal and what you do with what's left. Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., chairman of the Waterkeeper Alliance.
Using these giant machines and 2,500 tons of explosives, the power of a Hiroshima bomb once a week, they are blowing the tops off the mountains to get at the coal seams beneath. Then they take these giant machines and they scrape the rock and debris and rubble into the hollows and into the adjacent river valleys.
Under the Clean Water Act, it was illegal to put waste in water. But now the Bush administration wants to change that as well.
But in every state in this country, to dump rock, debris, rubble, garbage, any solid material into any waterway of the United States without a Clean Water Act permit. All you need today, according to the administration, is a rubber stamp permit from the Corps of Engineers, which in some districts you can get over the telephone.
Kennedy says if the rule change goes through, mining industries could flatten an area the size of Delaware. But Jeffrey Homestead, former EPA and White House official who testified at the hearing, says an end-of-term rush by a president is normal.
Look, it is a historical fact that near the end of every administration, there's a lot of things that get done because people respond to deadlines. All of the issues that I know about have been in the regulatory process for years.
On Wednesday, the administration reneged on another key area proposed changes that would have allowed more pollution. But many say it will be up to Obama to do the hard work. Experts at the hearing say Obama should put a stay, veto, or have Congress review any rule changes that are found to be inconsistent with the law. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
On Wednesday evening, after occupying their factory for 6 days, the workers at Republic Windows and Doors, members of the United Electrical Workers Union 1110, won the severance package they'd been seeking. A loan of $1.7 million, primarily from Bank of America, the company's main financer, will allow the company to pay each worker roughly $6,000, keeping compliant with federal law. The workers' decision to use the militant labor tactic of occupying their factory has not been used in the United States since the late 1930s. It garnered the workers' national media attention and widespread solidarity from other unions and social justice groups. It also put great pressure on the company to negotiate. For our Street Beat segment, FSRN reporter Jerry Mead Lucera asked workers, union organizers, and supporters whether they thought the confrontational tactics were a good idea that should be employed by unions more often.
I don't have any choice. The company says you fight. The company not give me the money for benefit in vacation time. I don't lose anything. I stay here and say, oh, you want? You don't pay me? The company say, no, I don't give you anything. Okay, I am stay here. Everybody together stay here. Say, in one time, I can stay here. You know, it's a big decision. A fast decision, too. Everybody say yes.
We just had to stand up and fight, man. We couldn't just walk away and let them just treat us like that after all these years. We had to stand up as one.
There's more of us than them in the banking industry, and real change is possible. There is an opportunity to gain some justice for the workers.
I think this is a show now that the workers in this country, they don't have to be afraid to stand up for their rights. And then, plus, I'm hoping that the companies will get the message that, hey, these workers are not just going to tolerate this anymore.
The sit-in is an excellent way for workers to, you know, share their message and to get attention to something that really needs to be paid attention to.
It was probably the last step and the only step people could take for people to notice. But what I'm excited about is that Americans are excited and believe this is a good thing.
I think it's been the best thing since the late 30s. I think, probably the best tactic at this time when there's so many factories closing. Why not push for self-management? Do we really need bosses? Is there anything that we could do without them? Yes, there is. Everything. I think it's a perfect response. I think UE is setting the example of how to handle this economic crisis.
I just hope, honestly, that we will see more of this action taken. We do hope that this will address those issues, you know, in terms of workers getting screwed over constantly. I hope that politicians will pay more, you know, a closer attention as well.
This is a means of obtaining justice without unnecessarily hurting people. So, you know, more power to them. Hopefully we start seeing more things like this and more direct action at the, you know, at the point of production, because that's where the power lies, you know.
You just heard from Ricardo Ceceres, William Swanson, Carmen Ortloff, Ron Bender, Jenna Enders, Larry Spivak, Robert Austin, Letitia Marquise, and Brian Brown. Workers and their supporters at Chicago's Republic Windows and Doors plant. Workers settled with the company last night. Those voices were recorded and produced by Jerry Mead Lucero. We continue our week-long series on human rights. Today, we'll go to Argentina. But first, we turn to San Francisco, where LGBTQ activists participated in the national Day Without a Gay. It's modeled after a Day Without an Immigrant protest 2 years ago. Organizers asked LGBTQ people not to go to work or spend money, but volunteer or do other activities. Activists wanted to continue to call attention to the lack of legal protections for LGBTQ people, including the recent passage of Prop 8 in California. Africa Jones reports.
Although not all LGBT people refrain from working and spending money, many throughout the country participated in local events. In San Francisco, hundreds of people gathered in the heart of the Mission District for a rally, then marched to the Castro District. Kat Kim organized the event through jointheimpact.com.
Queer rights, women's rights, rights for all people, these are all human rights issues, not special interest things.
Kim says that although the LGBT community has made progress, there's still a long way to go.
President Obama just appointed Nancy Sutley to his administration, the first openly lesbian or queer or bi person to be appointed. You know, that's progress. But at the same time, we hear reports of hate crimes. People still think that homophobia is a valid reason to kill people. And so there's a lot of progress to be made.
In California, the movement for LGBT equality has centered on same-sex marriage rights. Proposition 8, the constitutional amendment defining marriage as between a man and a woman, was passed last month. Assemblymember Tom Amiano, speaking at the rally, said that eventually things would change.
Harvey Milk knew very well this road. You lose a few and then you win. You lose a few and then you win. For us, we've already won. It's just a matter of the courts. It's just a matter of us sustaining.
Other speakers at the rally stressed it was important that the community stick together. Activist Andrea Shorter has spearheaded efforts promoting dialogue between the LGBT and African American communities.
They have been trying to pit us against each other.
That's right.
Don't fall for the okey-doke. When it comes to the issue of marriage equality, our greatest asset will always remain the diversity that we see here today. Period.
Stuart Gaffney is one of the original plaintiffs who filed suit to change the state's same-sex marriage ban and was among the first to get married when it was overturned. He says that his wedding day was one of the best days of his life.
My husband and I have been together for 21 years, and this summer we finally were able to get legally married, and we are standing up for our marriage, we're standing up for our family. If there's any silver lining to the passage of Prop 8, it's that we woke up next day and saw that discrimination had been written into the Constitution, and this cannot stand.
Many at the march say they will continue to hold protests and vigils against the passage of Proposition 8. The state Supreme Court examines a challenge against the law in March. Reporting from San Francisco for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
Now to Argentina, where human rights groups rallied yesterday and today in an annual 24-hour march to mark International Human Rights Day. This is the 28th year the mothers of Plaza de Mayo have held the march of resistance to demand justice for crimes committed during Argentina's 1976 to 1983 military dictatorship. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
Carrying a banner emblazoned with photos of Argentina's disappeared, dozens of mothers de Plaza de Mayo marched to the historic Plaza de Mayo in Buenos Aires.
31 años y seguimos reclamando. ¿Dónde están? ¿Dónde están?
A mother cries, "For 31 years we've been protesting. Where are they?" For more than three decades, the mothers of Plaza de Mayo have demanded information into the whereabouts of their children who were kidnapped and murdered during the nation's bloody military dictatorship. Some 30,000 activists, students, and labor organizers were disappeared, taken by commando groups to clandestine detention centers, tortured, and later their bodies were dropped from planes into the Atlantic Ocean. Nora Cortinas is a mother of Plaza de Mayo, now 81 years old. She says that mothers hold the March of Resistance every year to demand justice for their children and to defend human rights today.
28 marchas son. Hace 31 años que empezamos a venir a la Plaza de Mayo.
28 marches we've held. 31 years ago we began coming to the Plaza de Mayo. We always carry the anguish of not knowing what happened to all and every single one of our sons and daughters. This is our struggle, and this is why we continue to hold the March of the Resistance. A group of mothers are going to stay in the plaza until after midnight to hold a vigil, to complete the 24-hour march like we've always done.
During this year's March of the Resistance, human rights groups stressed the slow pace of human rights trials to try military personnel who carried out crimes during the dictatorship. Justice is now legally possible since the Supreme Court nullified the amnesty for military leaders through the full stop and due obedience laws passed in the 1990s. However, many worry whether the mothers of Plaza de Mayo, many who are well into their 80s, will live to see ex-military leaders convicted and put behind bars for their crimes against humanity. President of Mothers de Plaza de Mayo, Tati Almeida, says that many of the ex-military leaders may die in their homes rather than in jails where they belong.
We were able to open a political space for the impunity laws to be annulled. That's why we were able to begin the trials against those who committed genocide. Justice has been slow. The mothers do not have time. Those who committed genocide are dying, and mothers are dying on us too.
The human rights vigil concluded with a torch-lit march to mark International Human Rights Day. Mothers and supporters made rounds in the historic Plaza de Mayo throughout the night and into the early morning. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
Pakistan Prime Minister Yusuf Raza Gilani played cool to Indian media reports, which said India may have prepared its navy to blockade Pakistan's only commercial seaport at Karachi. But incidentally, Karachi is used for supplying the U.S. and NATO forces in landlocked Afghanistan. Recent attacks on transit depots near the northern city of Peshawar will bring the Pakistani government under further criticism for failing to control the Taliban. Our correspondent Masoor Hussain reports from Islamabad.
Consecutive attacks took place on Sunday and Monday nights in Peshawar. Militants came in pickup trucks at around 3 in the morning. First, they sprinkled petrol over the parked vehicles and then used a hand grenade to ignite them. In a matter of few minutes, the $10 million worth military vehicles were reduced to a charred junkyard. What are the ramifications of this brazen attack? Ghani Jafar is a researcher at the Islamabad-based think tank Institute of Strategic Studies.
Of course, it does speak in the first place of the decreasing reliability for the NATO and American troops to use this transit through Pakistan for their logistical supplies in Afghanistan. But let's not forget that this is not the only route that they have for the purpose. They already have bases in two of the Central Asian republics, which can be used to a greater extent.
But will this not make Pakistan irrelevant in the so-called war against terror?
No, I mean, let's be clear on this thing. This supply route, as I said, is in to begin with not that crucial for NATO. And secondly, the irrelevance would be if the border areas along Afghanistan and Pakistan were fully settled, which they are not anything but settled. And there's increasing activity there on both sides of the Durand Line, and increased demand by the NATO forces for greater Pakistani role.
Although Taliban have not claimed responsibility for this attack so far, their leader Hakimullah last week did warn of future attacks on supplies he said were meant for Afghanistan's national army. Rabia Akhtar is a lecturer at the Fatima Jinnah Women's University.
Bush administration, rather than giving a timeline for taking forces out of Afghanistan, have pledged dollars to aid the defense forces of Afghanistan, have given this aid to Karzai government to help equip the armed forces, and have not given a deadline for taking the coalition forces out of Afghanistan. This recent wave of violence, I don't think, is going to end anytime soon.
Attacks on supplies for the Western troops are expected to rise, which may force policymakers in Washington to rethink their military strategies. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussain in Islamabad.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. For Catherine Comp, Vinod K. Jose, Jess Burns, Puck Lowe, Rose Kadopchi, I'm Leanne Caldwell in Washington, D.C., sitting in for Otto Bogato.